So, I don't know if I did it, but my name is Trent Robinson. I'm one of the leaders here. Welcome. Here's what you need to know about me. I hate scary movies. I hate them. Some people love to be scared. It's that thrill for them, right? For me, like, if I want a thrill, I want to go skydiving. I think that would be fun. I just need to convince my wife, because I didn't do it before I got married, and now I have a restriction. But back to scary movies. When I was a teenager, my best friend Jonathan and I were persuaded by his sister to watch a scary movie with her. It was called Fear Island. The premise is rather basic. This movie is five teenagers, basically, on spring break, go to a secluded island cabin in the woods, all the boats leave, and people start dying. Pretty typical scary movie. And we make it about halfway through before my parents called. And they were like, okay, are you going to spend the night at Jonathan's house? And this is common for us. We lived three doors apart from each other. We were neighbors. So it was very common for us to just stay at whoever's house we were hanging at. No biggie, right? But a new obstacle was presented. If I'm going to spend the night, I have to go home to grab some supplies that I need to spend the night. But the outside is now scary because we're halfway through a horror movie where people start dying and it's ambiguous and a nail gun is like shot through a window and you're like, what is happening? And so we make a quick stop in the kitchen. We prep. And in sheer panic, we sprint from house to house, full pace. He's holding a meat tenderizer in his hand. I'm holding a whisk as if this is going to stop an intruder that comes to kill us at 11 p.m. We get to the house and, you know, we hide our tools and we grab what we need and we make it back to his house. The short of it all is we watch the rest of the movie. It was rather dumb. And then we probably spend the rest of the night playing video games if I know anything about me and my friend, right? So, what's the point? Why did I just tell you this, right? It's because fear is a very real thing. And we need to learn a healthy attitude and approach to fear. So if fear is a part of life, and I'm going to say it is, I think fear is a part of life. So some aspect, even if you are rather fearless, you will still have fear somewhere. The goal is not to end it. It is not to pretend that it does not exist. And it's not to act as if we have it all together, because all of those things we can do, but they are in vain. We won't actually accomplish it fully. So the goal instead is this: to end the control that fear can have over our thoughts, motives, and actions. So if fear cannot be eradicated, then why don't we just work toward fixing how much control it dictates in our lives? To act in faith rather than to react out of fear. And we do this by facing our fear and seeing Jesus as greater. So, this week and over the next 3 weeks, we are going to be on the road to the cross. The road to Easter, which is coming up. And Easter is this event that we celebrate of the death and the resurrection of Jesus. So we are going to be looking at the stories, the core stories, because we could spend a whole year looking at the stories that lead to the cross. But we're going to be looking in 4 weeks at just what leads us here. And so, I have a challenge for you. It's outside of the scope or the flow of this sermon, but if you want to participate, it is on you. I am not forcing it. No one is going to push it on you. This is your choice based on your own reflection, but I'll put it out there. I want to invite some of you to fast or to abstain from something during these 3 weeks. Jesus prepared himself for the ultimate sacrifice, giving himself away, taking the wrath of God on himself. And in this small thing, I think we get to look and participate with him. Just to say, I'm going to give up something that's normal. So like for me, if I said, I'm going to give up coffee, that does nothing for me. I don't drink coffee. It doesn't take away anything from my normal. I'll never notice that it's gone because I don't like coffee. But if you tell me I'm going to take away sugar from myself, I'm going to stop eating sugar for the next 3 weeks. Well, I love candy. I love soda and I love desserts. I will notice it is gone. And so that's the practice here, is to take away something that is out of your normal Not something that harms you, right? Like, don't take away all food and water. You will die. But take away something that is in your normal. It disrupts your normal. And then when you miss that thing, think about Jesus and what he did for us on the cross and prepare our hearts in celebration as we walk towards Easter. It's a challenge if you want to take it. Totally on you. So, I told you we are going to walk the road to the cross, which means we have a lot of ground to cover today because we only have a couple weeks to do it. So let's start at the very beginning. Who is Jesus? So God sent his son Jesus down. So Jesus is God's son, divine. He is also born of a Virgin Mary, so he is human. And him being sent down by God has been the plan since the beginning, since Genesis. Ever since man first sinned, Jesus was prophesied to come down and save the world, to save us from our sins, to crush the serpent's head, as Genesis 3 talks about, and the serpent is going to strike his heel, which means it's costly. So now on the earth, Jesus has come. He was born of a virgin. He's grown to the approximate age of 30. And he has begun his ministry on the earth by calling his disciples, by teaching in authority, and by performing miracles. Many have believed in him, and they have become his followers. And others, namely the Pharisees, the religious leaders, they have resented him. And now they have started plotting to stop him and to kill him. Because they don't like what he is doing. They don't believe in him. They don't recognize him for who he is. And they see him as a threat. So John 11 is where we're going to be today. And it picks up with Jesus in the town of Jordan. He has just spent time debating with these very Pharisees. And their desire to see him dead as they're debating is only growing because they are stuck in their ways. They have hardened hearts towards him. And they're thinking to themselves, who is this man to call himself the Good Shepherd, the Messiah? Who is this man to make that claim? And so we're going to read John 11, verse 1. He has now left the Pharisees, and we're going to read. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. And this is foreshadowing a story. Most would know it, but this story has still not yet occurred, so it's coming. We as readers would be able to recognize and know it. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is sick. Jesus and Lazarus have a close friendship, and that includes Mary and Martha. All four of them are very closely knit. And it's close enough that they feel the need to give him a heads up. Hey, Jesus, the one you love is sick. In addition, we can also infer that Lazarus is probably pretty sick. I mean, if it's just an allergy attack or a little bug bite, they're probably not telling Jesus. They're not like, hey, Jesus, you should probably come. Like, Lazarus has a bug bite. But Lazarus is probably sick to the point where they're worried he's going to die. They are fearing his death. So, Jesus has a close connection. The sickness is present and it's very threatening. In our minds, I think we all imagine Jesus springing to action and he starts his journey immediately and he's getting his miraculous hands warmed up. He's getting ready to heal, right? But Jesus' response is so weird for us. See, all of the people, Lazarus, Martha, Mary, they have this fear that they are going to lose Lazarus. And so they hold this expectation, Jesus will come and heal him. But when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory that God's son may be glorified through it. And the disciples are hearing this thinking, okay, so he's not worried because Lazarus is going to be perfectly fine. He's going to make a full recovery. God's glory is shown in the fact that he is so confident he is not even going to go. And sweet, because I don't want to go. That's a long journey. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. And then he said to his disciples, let us go back to Judea. And this is so weird to me. There's like an urgency in him. Like, it sounds like it's, like, really important. And then he's like, so we're going to stay here 2 more days, and then we're going to go. Right? Like, Jesus is currently in Jordan. To go to Judea is a couple days of travel because they have to go by foot. And so he's really not showing urgency, but his words seem like urgent. And you have Mary, Martha, and Lazarus all worried about what might happen to Lazarus. And Jesus is not. And it begs the question, why? Why is Jesus not worried? Is it because he doesn't actually care for his friend? Is it because he's mistaken for the first time and Lazarus, he actually believes Lazarus isn't going to die? Maybe that's it. Or maybe it's the fact that he knows something that we don't. He knows that faith casts out fear. He knows that faith casts out fear. See, Matthew 8, a different story, shows his disciples in a boat, in a storm, panicking while Jesus is asleep. And the storm is rising. They are getting so scared, so they go and wake up Jesus. For Jesus to wake up and immediately say, "Why are you afraid, O you of little faith?" That statement reveals that there is a correlation between faith and fear. Why are you afraid, O you of little faith? The idea is that when one increases, the other should decrease, which means that standing in the confidence of God, who he is, what he has done, what he is going to do, is how we fight fear. To know that he has this is how we fight fear. And thankfully, we're going to see it traced out in the story because there's a lot of people afraid and there is a Jesus that is very confident. Psalm 56:3 says, "When I am afraid, I put my trust in you." The psalmist knows the source of his comfort and confidence. So funny enough, I just said it, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus are not the only ones scared in this story. We actually have three parties scared and we're going to walk through them. First is Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, scared about Lazarus' death. The next, "But Rabbi," said the disciples, "a short while ago the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you are going back?" So the word is out. The religious leaders want Jesus dead. They might have tried already, right? And the disciples are thinking to themselves, "That's terrifying. Why would we go back to where they're trying to kill you? This seems unwise." They have the fear, "We're going to die." It's not two parties afraid, right? Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." Trust me, he's saying. He's telling his disciples in language that might not say it this clearly, right? But trust me, I know the end of the story. I'm the light, and I'm with you, so you're not going to stumble. I know the whole story. After he had said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up." And Jesus knows what he's saying, but the disciples don't. They don't get it. They say, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better." I agree. Like if somebody's sleeping, I'm like, yeah, they'll recover. It'll be great. So that's what they're thinking. Jesus had been speaking of his death, but the disciples thought he meant natural sleep. They didn't get it. And this is why I love Jesus. He like tries to tell them one way. They don't get it. So then he's just like, "I'm going to tell you plainly, Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I'm glad I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Jesus is intentional every step of the way. And it feels wrong to us in some of his steps. Like my natural instinct is get up and go. My friend needs me. I can do something. So I need to go before. I need to be urgent. And he's intentional. And what is he intentional in doing? He's making every single person, every single group face their fears. And he's going to show how much more power God has over them. His glory is going to increase when they face their fears instead of running away from them. So then Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us go that we may die with him." And I love this because Thomas has a horrible rap. Like he gets, people treat Thomas poorly. You know, Doubting Thomas, that's his nickname. Thomas doubted and he didn't get the same encounter with the resurrected Jesus as the others did. And so he says, "I'm not going to believe unless I get to stick my finger in the hole of his hand where he has been pierced." And we call him Doubting Thomas. But in this moment, he is the one leading the charge, showing no doubt at all, saying, "Let's go die with him." I think it's worth mentioning that we're all human, which means that we're all going to doubt from time to time. We're all going to have our moments of greatness and our moments of things that we might feel a little shameful for. We're all human. So it's time to decide. That's what Jesus is putting before them. It's time to decide. Do you trust me or do you trust your fears? Because both are calling for action, and it can't be both. Are you going to run away from what might harm you, or are you going to run to what might astonish you and will ultimately save you? Are you going to stay by my side? Because you can't run in opposite directions at the same time. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been dead, or in the tomb for 4 days, been dead for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. And Martha is different than Mary. Martha is a doer. She's the I must fix it person. So she gets up and she runs to Jesus immediately. And Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. If only reveals something about the heart. If only is backward looking. It looks at your past. It focuses on the regret of things that could have been, the resentment of things that were wronged. It says, why didn't you, God? And it solves nothing. If only. As long as your life is characterized by this if only statement, if you live in the if onlys, you will never move forward. You will never find healing. And you will destroy your very own joy because you're not living where God has put you in the present. You're living in what could have been, what might should have been in your mind. But even now, those words have so much power. Even now, when Jesus is involved in the story, it is not over. So Martha says, she says the if only, and then she says, but even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask. So I can't see it. I don't understand. Maybe I'm disappointed in Jesus. You didn't heal him the way I thought you were going to keep him alive. My brother is dead. But I'm still going to choose to believe that even now, you are still God. So it doesn't explain it. But it looks for it. It invites God in. And faith always unlocks doors so that even now has power to say maybe things have been wrong in your past. Maybe you have been beaten, battered, and bruised. And now you live in the if-onlys of what if that didn't happen, right? But one of the most healing things you can do is say even now, regardless of what has been, even now I know God is going to take me to new places. He is going to grow me, heal me. I trust him. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know he will rise again. In the resurrection, at the last day, she has knowledge. In this moment, she is displaying her knowledge. She's displaying her trust in a way. But Jesus is making her actively have faith in this moment for something that seems very absurd to her. She's saying, yeah, I know, like, you're going to call him up. He's going to be in heaven. That's great. I'm excited about that. But he's saying, no, like, even now I have a blessing. But I need you to face your fear, Martha. He said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, and even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this, Martha? Do you believe this, Martha? God will use circumstances. He will use your circumstances over and over again to lead you to the truth of his power so that you will respond. He will use circumstances to show his might and power in your life in hopes that you will respond and say, yes, you are God. I know this to be true. And she said, yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world. And after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here, she said, and is asking for you. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now, Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. And when the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her. supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. So they wanted to be good Jews and follow her and comfort her. And when Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died." If only. She has to face the exact same challenge, the exact same fear that Martha has just been through with Jesus. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along also with her weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. He's perfect in every way. He wept. I think this teaches us two or three things here. Jesus wept. The reality of death, sin, and destruction is actually something that should grieve our hearts. I don't think we need to feel guilty about that. Like, death was never the original design. It is actually something so broken. So it should grieve our hearts. I think it also teaches us that relationships are very real and very important. Jesus is not some robot that came and was programmed on a mission to just go, live perfectly, and die. There's relationships in that. He was a relational man, which means that when his friend is dead in that tomb, he actually feels something. When his friends are grieving, he actually feels something. God's own son wept. Number three, does that not give us permission to grieve, to hurt, to cry? I love a good cry. I always feel better after a good cry. Maybe I'm not supposed to say that because I'm a man, right? Ooh. But I love a good cry. Jesus wept. And then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." And we were like, yes. But then some of them, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" You got the supporters and the cynics. Man's opinion will throw you from side to side until you are battered and confused. Think of it like a snow globe and you're in the middle, right? Man's opinion is like this. God's opinion, God's voice in your ear holds you steady. You're not going to be hitting the side walls and feel destroyed because you're living for this person's opinion and then this person's opinion, and you just keep going from side to side and you are being washed away. God's voice is steady. It is unchanging. Live for that. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. A stone and burial cloths will soon seal Jesus off from the outside world. That is what's coming in his future. So Lazarus is about to serve as an example of God's might, also of God's knowledge, because this is literally what is about to come. His exact fate will be that stone rolled and the burial cloths left. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been in there for 4 days." And I love this, because women tend to be very practical, right? They want to know the how before they know the what. "How can this be? Because I have not had relations with a man. How am I going to have a son?" Mother Mary asking. Some of us are so busy with daily life and all the details that seem to not add up and all the restrictions and all the challenges in life that we miss or disrupt what God wants to do in our very lives. Jesus is saying, "Yes, Martha, he's dead. Yes, Martha, it's going to smell. I get it. But to leave the sight alone is to miss the miracle. To live in fear is to rob what faith can accomplish." And it's not a condemnation to Martha, but it is a challenge. Face the fear. Set aside the details. Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe you have sent me." So, you were afraid that he's going to die. And he did. I'm going to redeem that fear so that people believe you are blessed and God is glorified. And he does in this moment. When he had said this, Jesus called out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." And the "come out" in the Greek carries the idea of "you don't belong there. Come this way out. Come to my voice." And the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." He reveals in this moment his glory. He is God, undoubtedly, the one who has power over life and death. He has power over greater than whatever you're afraid of. If he can conquer death, that he shows in this moment, then he has power over whatever you're afraid of. Whatever these people around him are afraid of. And the worst still happens, church. The healing has to be more than just about the healing. Because Lazarus is going to die again. I don't know if you know that, but we die as humans. So even though he is raised from the death and now this illness isn't the thing that took him, one day he is going to die again. Jesus is going to be killed. And so this resurrection of Lazarus has to be more than just raising him to die again. That seems insane to me. Healing the blind man has to be more than just giving him sight, because one day he's going to lose sight again. The man with leprosy who is cured, one day his body is going to decay again. These miracles specifically testify to Jesus having power over our bodies and life and death. Being more than just a teacher and prophet, that's why this miracle matters. It gives him the authority. The people believing, the people following him get to believe in what he is doing. Because he is not just a good man that is going to die a good death. He is a good man who was sent on a mission by God, empowered. And he has power over life and death. So, why this story? I told you we've got a lot to cover. There's a lot of things. There's so many stories that we could pick. Why this story? On our road to Easter, on the road to the cross, I'm going to give you three reasons. Number one, it reminds us that fear exists and that faith is greater. There is a ridiculous number of things in this world that we can and do fear. There's a ridiculous number of things. And at its core, death tends to be a universal one. Like, all of mankind has to wrestle with the fear of death at some point. Because it's real. And whether it be lost relationships or the pain that comes when death comes for you or the unknown, it can be terrifying. And some of us live actively in the fear of it and some of us don't. But one way or another, we have dealt with it at some point. Fear will be present from time to time. So Jesus utilizes a time where everyone is fearing for Lazarus's death, where the disciples are fearing for their own lives, and the third group, I never even mentioned it. The religious leaders are fearing that they are going to be overthrown and taken by Rome. That Rome is going to come in and execute all of them because Jesus is forming a movement and Rome always fears movements. And all of this, Jesus leverages to give us a clear reminder. Faith casts out fear. Faith is more powerful than fear. God has set us free, so fear does not have the authority to rule us. Number two, why this story? It foreshadows Jesus. I already mentioned it, but it foreshadows Jesus. Jesus is very soon going to die, be put in a tomb, wait for 3 days, and walk out of the tomb, removing the grave cloths, the burial cloths, and confounding every single person. And while he has not hidden this truth throughout his journey, while he has talked about it, while he has foreshadowed it over and over again, this is further proof. We see a man that he loves do the exact same thing. Die, wait for 4 days, and get resurrected. Because he has power over life and death. And number three. I just quoted the coming verses. So right after we finish with Jesus calling Lazarus out of the dead is a section where the religious leaders are like, well, we got to kill him now. This man's a threat. And they're living actively in fear, right? And so it says, from this day on, they plotted to take his life. They were saying to themselves, if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. They feared Rome's power and their demise. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest this year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. What a statement. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. See, Rome in the past has shut down potential threats by maliciously killing everyone deemed a threat. They don't just cut off the head of the snake, they chop the snake up into 100 pieces. And so Caiaphas is stepping in to save a movement. He did not say this on his own, but as the high priest that year, he had prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. But not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and to make them one. So from that day, they plotted to take his life. And this is why he came to die. It gives us a beautiful picture, a beautiful illustration of why this cross is going to matter, why the resurrection even matters. To bring the scattered children home and make them one. That's his purpose, is to bring us home, give us hope, and unite us, that we would be a prepared bride for the groom. What do we do in our own power and with our own wisdom out of fear rather than trusting in God? Just as a moment of reflection, I have two questions. This is number one. What do we do in our own power and with our own wisdom out of fear rather than trusting in God? How does fear control us? And this is something that you pretty much have to figure out on your own. Where does fear cause you to compromise? Is it in work? Are you afraid of getting fired? Are you afraid of finances and so you live your life in a certain way? Are you afraid of loneliness and so you just give yourself out and just hope that you can find somebody? What are you afraid of? And how does that fear rule your life? And then as a follow to that, what would happen if you gave Jesus control? What if your faith actually overruled your fear? What would change in your life? Would anything change? Would anything change? I know things would change for me. If I wasn't ruled by fear in certain areas, I know some things would change. And I'll tell you the broad strokes. I darn as well would be more joyful in certain areas. I would be more confident. Because faith instills us with joy and confidence and peace. Fear instills us with scarcity and being scared. Fear robs us of these things. And I think God wants us to live in the confidence, peace, and joy found in his presence. That's what he's called us to. That's why he saved us. That's why the resurrection and the crucifixion are going to matter. So as you reflect on these, would you bow your heads and pray with me?